Welcome to the West Elk Word. I'm Tony Todd, here with Carlton Mason. Carlton is with CASA of the 7th Judicial District. That's CASA, which stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates, and the 7th Judicial District of Colorado, which is located in Montrose, but serves several other counties as well, including Gunnison. And we're here today to hear about a successful housing project, or more than one successful housing projects, on the Western Slope in the Montrose Delta area. So, Carlton, thank you, and welcome to the West Elk Word.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. So, my name is Carlton Mason. I'm the CEO for CASA of the 7th Judicial District, and I've been in this position for around 11 years. So, a little bit about how we got here, how we got into the housing. When I joined CASA, it was a fairly small organization with a budget of about $250,000 a year. We had about 800 square feet of office space, and we focused on providing CASA advocates in the courts, which are community members that volunteer. They go through a significant amount of training and then are assigned by the court to a dependency and neglect case where there is either abuse and neglect in the home. We enjoyed, it's a great program. We did a lot of supervised visitation for non-custodial parents. We still do that also. But over the course of the first 3 or 4 years, we began to see that young people were coming out of the system and still dealing with homelessness and the transition to independence, which was really hard for them. So, you know, it just sort of began to cook in our brains. What should we be doing about this? Is this our problem? Then we began to run across data where it showed that 50% of the homeless population had spent time in foster care. And some estimates are even higher than that. And we just felt like this is our issue. Like, we need to be, you know, it's great to help a kid till they're 18 years old, but at 18, nothing really magical happened. And once again, if we walk away or don't have that supportive role, kids are going to struggle to transition towards independence. So we began conversations. We actually built with a bunch of kids at a local charter school and the Brown Center, which was open at the time for young boys. We built a tiny house, loved seeing the young people work on it and just learn skills that took things they were learning in their education at school, in their studies, and made them very practical and hands-on, like, oh, now I know why fractions matter, or, you know, how do I make sure the walls square? Well, we use simple geometry, things like that that really helped them understand. And they began to see that problems could be fixed, which I think a lot of our young people in these situations have not learned. They've learned a chaotic response to a problem instead of a healthy restorative response. So that's kind of the beginning. And in 2018, we opened our first supportive housing. It was the first supportive housing in the state of Colorado, specifically for kids coming out of foster care or dealing with homelessness. And then in 2020, we opened another project in Delta. And then here in last fall, we opened the Village on San Juan, which is a total of 45 homes.
That's impressively fast. How were you able to get those three completed so quickly?
Well, let's be honest. It's a pretty sellable idea. Like, we all know that when we turned 18, we were still trying to figure life out. And then you move from that equation, parents or supportive adults, and everybody understands this isn't going to go well. So It was an easy sell, and that was back, we started, I think, in 2016 or 2017. I think it spent a total of maybe 7 or 9 months, and we raised $1.2 million. Some of that was Division of Housing. Some of it was grants. Some of it was local community members just pouring out some support. It was just really fun to watch, and we had the project up and running, and I think from start to finish, like starting the fundraising, having the concept of the idea to completion and moving kids in was about 18 months. The project is right downtown. It's a block off Main Street. But we really didn't get into conversations around what is supportive housing and what are the needs. It just moves so quickly that before everybody kind of knew what happened, I mean, the city went through planning, it went through everything, it was there. And when it opened, we really tried with the neighbors around it to make sure they knew what was coming and what we were doing. We did have one neighbor that was upset by the work. And, understandably, like I get it. The young people we work with have behavioral health needs. They could be dealing with addictions that came out of abuse and just life patterns that were unhealthy. So, I understood, but we at least had those conversations and we just sort of like walked into them. It wasn't long, the project in Delta, we started it and it went really fast. The village on San Juan, we felt like took a long time, but it ended up costing, 12, 11, $12 million. So it took some time to figure out how to raise that kind of capital.
Tell me how they work. I know that most affordable housing developments have some sort of rules and parameters and income restrictions and
That's a really great question. So, supportive housing is created to take individuals who are either homeless or at imminent risk for homelessness and walk alongside them with case management services. Now, we can't force those tenants to engage with us in case management services. We have to create a trusting bond or a relationship in order to get them to engage. But as far as special rules, we have nothing but the laws that everyone else is governed by. We've gone through quite a learning process on how to build that trust, what approach works, how to get tenants to engage. At one point, we hit 100% employment. We average probably between 70 and 80% of the young people employed that we work with. They do well. Some have such significant health problems coming out of trauma and childhood events that they maybe can't hold a job.
Do you have income restrictions, requirements, or are the houses provided for
So
free?
in supportive housing, their income needs to be at 30% of the area median income or below. So that
Okay.
is a pretty significant, I mean, that's a low income.
Yeah, very low.
The village on San Juan, we also built 12 units of 80% AMI, which is actually affordable housing. So there's kind of a separation there. One is supportive housing, and that comes with intensive case management and services and a host of other referrals and opportunities. And then there is affordable housing, which is basically just rent restricted, defined by income levels,
Is
80%.
that the type of thing where they pay 30% of whatever their income is?
Yeah, it's pretty close to that. So
Okay.
if in other words, our one bedroom or two bedroom, our one bedroom I think is $1,200 or $1,400 a month. And that still sounds high, but it's actually less than what the market is.
So you've got a mixture then of supportive and affordable housing. Is there an advantage to that from a social standpoint?
Well, I think so. Here's the really interesting social experiment that's going on at the village on San Juan. 15 of the supportive housing, so 30 units are supportive housing. 15 of those are for young adults 18 through 24. 15 of those are for seniors 62 and over. And all of them have the same criteria. They've dealt with homelessness, they have behavioral health needs. So we do have very much a community out there that is, individuals getting up in the morning, going to work every day, to seniors who are at their final place, barring the need for more care. But they can live out their lives there. They're stable. They're probably on Social Security. And then you have the mix of these young people. And it's been a lot of fun to watch the connections that can be made. Yesterday, one of our senior tenants was parked out front, and I walked past the window and saw him, and so I walked out and said hello. And he had taken the time to bring one of the young tenants to a mental health appointment because he could, and they care about each other, and had an opportunity to share their stories. The senior who has been in Hollywood, spent years as a merchant marine, was a model at one point. Here he's dealing with homelessness, talking to a young lady who, and I don't know her full story, but I know, our kids usually either go through physical or sexual abuse or childhood trauma. They foster care. And so these two individuals, one of them in their 70s and one of them, 19 or 20, are sharing their stories and trying to figure out how they can benefit each other in navigating life. And it we have many examples of that occurring.
The reason I asked that question is because I flash back to when I was 18. Like you said, a lot of people realize that when you're 18, you're not fully baked yet, right? You're not really ready for independence. And I remember, I think the closest family member to me when I was 18 was my grandmother. We had a connection. And I know that that's common, that kids and grandparents connect sometimes in a way that's more intimate and more direct and more safe in some ways than with parents or other younger adults in their life. And so I wondered how the seniors and the youngsters, if they would do well paired together.
I mean, you're always going to find that senior that is like, I can't deal with the chaos of that generation. It's interesting you say that, because when we had the open house, I was approached by a lady from the community who said, "Well, kudos for, getting through all the problems you had to get through to build this." And I said, "Well, there actually weren't that many problems. Like, we didn't, where we're located, I have 8 acres of a conservation easement that we own behind us, so no neighbors there. I have a huge arroyo on the west, so there's and an industrial on the other side of that, so no problem there. To my east is more vacant property, so no problems there. To the south is an affordable housing project and vacant land. And yet we are right there on the bypass on the edge of town." And I said, "Well, we didn't really have a whole lot of, problems." "Well, you're gonna have problems." And I just smiled and I said, "Yeah, we probably are." Well, she said, "I just don't think seniors and young people are going to get along." And I got 5 grandchildren now, and I'm like, how could that be? Like, I can't imagine life without these young people. And even the young people that are out there, these are kids that I genuinely care about. I enjoy seeing them.
I think it's a great combination. It's a great experiment. It seems to be panning out for the most part.
It'll we're always going to have our stuff, but I had give you an example. We had a young lady get a job and didn't know how to use the public transportation system, and she went in to see my staff, her case manager, and said, "I how do I get to work? I don't know how to use the bus. Can you show me?" And my staff immediately paired her up with a senior who loves to use the public bus and said, "Why don't you two, would you help each other?" And the senior woman was like, "Oh, I'd love to." So they spent hour and a half, 2 hours, riding the bus, getting off, doing a little shopping, chatting. That event occurred. Month later, she ends up doing it again for another young tenant. They get on the bus. The bus driver has a leading role in the play at Magic Circle, or a role, I don't know if it's leading or not, but has a role in the play at Magic Circle and tells them, "You could come to the dress rehearsal for free." Next thing you know, I think we've got 7 or 9 tenants all in a van going for free to the dress rehearsal. And it's a mix of young people and seniors, and they're having a good time. So is it challenging? Absolutely. I don't in any way want to say that or imply that there are not challenges and some hurdles that we have to engage in, but it's the right thing. It's the right way to solve some of these problems, is allow people to understand that they can actually do this on their own.
Well, essentially, what you're creating is community. That's the idea. And there is no community on Earth that doesn't have issues and problems and conflicts. So yours would be no different. And yet, the fact that there is a community makes for a supportive environment between and among humans. And that's really essentially what you're doing.
I was approached by an individual who came in and said, I'm not sure I can support the village on San Juan. And I said, okay, that's okay. I mean, at this point, we're under construction. I'm like, it's going to happen. I wasn't naive enough to think I was going to get 100% support. So it's okay. I've met someone who doesn't support it. Anyhow, I'm like, okay, that's all right. Well, I just don't know how you're going to keep drugs out of there. And I looked at him and I said, me either. How do you keep drugs out of your neighbor's house? And he said, well, I don't know if I can. And I said, well, do you still have a responsibility to be a good neighbor? Yeah. I said, well, me too. So I said, I guess we agree on the fact that we do have a responsibility to be good neighbors. And simply because someone is struggling with a behavior or an addiction that creates maybe additional headaches for the rest of us doesn't mean we get to step back and dismiss them or isolate them out of society.
If you are just joining us here today on the West Elk Word, I'm Tony Todd, here with Carlton Mason. Carlton is from CASA and the 7th Judicial District. CASA, CASA, stands for Court Appointed Special Advocates. We're discussing two types of housing needed in Western Slope communities, supportive housing and affordable housing. Tell us how you were able to put all the pieces together to get to the point of construction. You mentioned that the village on San Juan cost $12 million to build. When I think of 45 homes, that actually seems pretty reasonable. But plus grounds, and you have like a, I imagine a shared, few shared spaces, community spaces, that kind of thing. How did you manage to pull all the funding together? Was that just a matter of just diving into grant writing and talking with public officials and working with contractors, et cetera?
I do know that we looked at the project and said, one, it's the right thing to do. We know how to do it. We have the capacity to figure it out. And of course, at the time we were like, when we started, we were like, well, we need 15 units, but we had to buy the whole property. We tried giving away half the property to another organization, and they were like, nah, it won't fit for us. So we, the project started smaller with a sum of money that was easier, like maybe $3 or $4 million. And then we just kept looking at it, the timing with the state of Colorado, the funding they were putting out to put into housing, some money through Senator Bennett's office, grants, Area Agency on Aging was able to bring in $1.3 million when we partnered with doing housing for seniors. And we just constantly kept this notion in front of us that, like, this is the right thing to do. This is the right place to do it. And we just kept moving forward. And it did take us probably 8 months longer than I would have hoped to raise that money. But still, $12 million over the course of, I think it was probably 18 months or 20 months. I mean, we got it. And were there hurdles? Yeah, there still are. We do have a small, relatively small mortgage on the property, but those units that are 80% AMI are actually paying the mortgage and paying the insurance and keeping the project stable. I wish I can't really just sit here and say, oh, we were so smart. It's just more like it was timing for me, probably partly a God thing. Like, I mean, there was just all these elements that were like, I can't control all this. I only know what I need to get done. And so you wake up every day and you're like, I know what I need to get done. Let's just keep moving. And it occurred.
It sounds a bit like conviction had a lot to do with it. You keep saying that we just knew it was the right thing to do. And if that's the prevailing mantra going through your mind all the time, That's motivating, right?
It is. I mean, what's stronger motivation? And people could disagree with that conviction. Like I'm totally comfortable with that too. Like it's not the right thing for everybody to do. It was the right thing for us to do. And so, yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot of it comes down to, I mean, it's why I'm here. Like I'm not involved in CASA just simply because I want a job. I'm involved here because I believe in the potential of these young people and the importance of walking alongside them while they navigate some struggles in life.
How did the contracting work? Were you able to find contractors who would work for more reasonable rates, for example, than those building million-dollar houses down in Telluride or whatever?
We worked with Stryker Construction down here in Montrose, and I felt like they were incredibly reasonable. And I had spent, prior to being involved in CASA, I was involved in the construction industry for probably 20 years. And so a lot of the language, a lot of the elements of building things, a lot of the processes are things that I'm familiar with and not terribly intimidated by. But they were great. I think there were a lot of people on that project that believed in what they were doing, a lot of men that spent an entire almost 12 months like waking up every day and maybe driving a mile and a half to work instead of an hour and a half, doing a project that many of them could connect to, like many of them could see the need for or relate to the purpose for. There were contractors that did some in-kind or maybe they'd do 44 foundations and donate a foundation, or concrete company would donate so many yards of concrete. And so, yeah, there was a lot of just great community support. We had three quilting clubs. Came time, I mean, little details that you never think about, like, how am I going to put something on all these windows? We had three quilting clubs that mobilized and they sewed over 500 yards of fabric into curtains of all different, sizes. And we had a local artist donate a painting. So everybody had a painting on their wall. So it felt, warm and inviting.
That's really cool. So you had even the little homey touches to make people feel welcome.
People respond to how they are treated. I mean, that's all of us. That's just natural. And if someone walks into your space and is aggressive or assertive, or they'll put you on the defensive. But if you walk into someone's space, even someone who's experiencing homelessness or significant trauma through things that were totally beyond their control, it just mirrors itself. Like, in other words, if you walk into that space with respect and care and compassion and empathy, your chances of getting that back in return are much, much higher. Not 100%, but much higher.
What would you say to other communities who are looking at these kinds of projects?
We've had that question a lot, and we're always willing to help where we can. But there's a couple things when you ask that question that go through my mind. Housing is a resource. It is not the solution. It is a resource. And I think it's really important to mention. Think about that, especially in context of supportive housing, where you are serving individuals with significant needs. So, given that it's a resource, what is that key component that needs to occur? Not just the housing. Now you know where to find them. It's the relationships. You've really got to be willing to like know their name. In fact, that's one of the first questions that I'll ask an agency when they call and say, we want to build that kind of housing in such and such a town. And my first question is, so do you want to know their name, or do you just feel like if you can build the housing, you can get this problem off the streets? And if it's just simply get the problem off the streets, then I'm really not, I don't think I know the solution for you. If you have a group or individuals, or you're willing to commit to knowing who they are, like hearing their story, providing that safety so they can stabilize and grow, then I'm all in. And I think agencies can make it happen. One other thing comes to my mind when you ask that. What would I say to other agencies? Start with what you have the capacity to do. Our first project was 8 little townhomes. And many people came to me and said, well, that's not enough. You're going to need more. And I was like, yeah, but it's all I can do and do well. I mean, the problem is so large that we look at it and say, well, how do we solve this? Well, you're not going to. But you can break it down to what you can manage and do what you can manage. And so we started out with the 8, and we figured out, we went through a huge learning curve, figured out what we needed to be, who we needed to be to in order to effectively engage in this area. And so those are the two things I would say. Be willing to make a personal commitment or investment to know their name, to make them matter, and then do what you can do well. There's a tendency to think the problem is so huge. Why would five units matter? 5 units in 2 generations? That's a lot of people. And if we can begin to make that impact on one family or two families right now, well, then their 2 or 3 kids grow up in stability with a better shot. And then their kids grow up. I mean, that's the only way I know how to really start tackling this.
Anything else you'd like folks to know about these projects or about CASA and the 7th Ju Judicial District's efforts?
I think if, when people are thinking about how they'd like to give their time, if they want to volunteer as an advocate, they can always reach out to us. We always are looking for advocates in other areas. And sometimes it may be in the advocacy role, sometimes it may be other opportunities that arise. And then the last thing I would say is this is not for everybody, but if it's for you, you'll know it. And it is a whole lot of fun. These are amazing young people with incredible stories that once you take the time, you'll be like, oh, well, now this makes a little more sense. May not still be the target behavior you're looking for, but it's beginning to make sense. And I don't think we have maxed out on empathy or compassion in our society. We could always use a little more.
I would agree with that, 100%. Carlton Mason, it's been a delight. Thank you so much for joining me today on the West Elk Word.
Thank you.
Support for KBUT comes from Towny Books and Rumors Coffee and Tea House, serving locally roasted coffee and fine loose leaf teas. Towny Books stocks new books for children and adults and can special order anything. Drink coffee, read books, fight evil. That's it for this edition of the West Elk Word. You can catch up with our latest episodes at kbut.org. Thanks for joining us today. See you next time.